So thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. It's always very nice to be back in KRTP. Today what I'll be sort of talking about is what I think is an interesting limit of ADS-CFT, which sort of deserves some study. So this limit is a sort of a non-relativistic limit. But I should say at the outset itself that it will be different from the kind of non-relativistic limits that have been largely studied, in the sense that those non-relativistic limits, which you heard from Mukund over here, those of you who are here, Mukund's talk some weeks ago, probably heard about non-relativistic limits, which have the so-called Schrodinger symmetry. The kinematics here will be different, and in a way which I will sort of contrast in the introduction, just as a way of setting the frame. So I'll explain what these sort of, the notion of conformal symmetry in this non-relativistic limit that I'll be studying sort of is different from the Schrodinger conformal symmetry. It's what we call the Galilean conformal symmetry or Galilean conformal algebra, and I'll sort of tell you what's interesting about it and how there's a natural way in which it's realized in ADS-CFT, in particular in the bulk geometry, dual to this. So let me start with motivation and introduction. So there are sort of essentially two motivations. One is that, of course, it's interesting to study limits of ADS-CFT, which might be more tractable. In which you might focus on a subsector of modes for whose dynamics might be relatively simpler or more constrained by symmetry and so on. And of course, we all know about the BMN limit and various sort of descendants of that, all these different spin chains with SL2R, SU2, and so on. So definitely it makes sense to focus on various modes, of subsets of modes, the theory which might have dynamics which we can control a lot more. So that's certainly one motivation. And the second motivation is to sort of broaden the class of examples of if you wish, gauge string dualities. And I think broadening it in a way where you have control over the equivalence by taking a parametric limit of an equivalence we already understand fairly well, namely the relativistic case, I think offers you sort of more control in trying to make more reliable statements of duality between broader classes of theories. So one would like to enlarge the class of maybe strongly interacting field theories which would have string duals, and by taking limits of already understood dualities, that's a good way to arrive at them. So the systems we'll be considering, there will always be at the back of my mind a parent ADS-CFT duality. It could be n equal to 4 Young nulls, but not necessarily. And while in this part of the talk we'll focus on the dualities where there's a gravity dual of the bulk of the boundary theory, much of this will be independent even of that. So, So let me try to, so before I start telling you what this limit is and what this Galilean conformal algebra is, let me just contrast it a little bit with the Schrodinger symmetry, or the Schrodinger algebra. So one way to sort of define what the Schrodinger symmetry is to consider the set of all transformations that leave this operator, the Schrodinger wave operator for a free particle invariant, and so the invariances of this is one way to. To characterize the Schrodinger symmetry, though of course this symmetry could be realized in other systems as well, and one the interest is in realizing them in interacting systems, not just the free particle, and it may well be realized in systems with cold atoms and so on. So what are the symmetries of the Schrodinger operator? So apart from there are of course the Galilean symmetries. So in and we'll sort of look at 3+1 dimension just for definiteness, though much of this is easily generalized. So the Galilean symmetries are a 10-parameter group of which you have 3 spatial rotations, 3 spatial translations, 3 boosts along the different spatial directions, and 1 time translation. So these are all the same generators as in the Poincaré group, but just the algebra is the one that's consistent with the Galilean transformations. And then there's usually a central term, which is in the commutator of the boosts. I'll denote the boost by B. I and J go over the spatial indices, and so the boost with the translations can admit a central term, and this parameter M is indeed the same as that. So these are the standard Galilean transformations, which are symmetries of this operator. But there are a couple more symmetries. So one is also a fairly obvious symmetry, which is a dilatation symmetry, in which you scale the spatial directions uniformly, but at the same time you scale time with a factor of lambda square, so that then obviously this transform. S psi equal to 0 is left invariant by this transformation. So this
symmetry is broken by a constant potential.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Adding a constant to the energy, which non-relativistic means, meaningless breaks the symmetry. It's sort of an unnatural symmetry from our point of view.
Yeah. but there are interacting systems in which this is supposed to be realized. I don't know. Mukund has anything more to say about that. I won't be talking so much about this. Right. So.
But it's sort of strange that it's broken by what is normally a non-relativistic physics.
Just a trivial constant, right? Unless you scale that constant in the same way as this, which is also trivial, it just shifts. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I won't be saying very much about this Schrodinger symmetry apart from these few words. It's mainly to contrast it with contrast what I'll be saying later with this, and to make the distinction clear. So in terms of as a vector field, if you wish. The generator is just this. There's this factor of 2 over here. So this is the non-relativistic dilatation operator. There's also another symmetry, which is a little less obvious, which is a kind of an inversion symmetry. So these are the finite versions of this inversion symmetry, and the infinitesimal generator for this is there's no factor of 2 here, so it's just x. It's mu, it's just the parameter of your finite transformation, just like lambda. So the infinitesimal transformation is generated by this. So this is like an inversion, I mean inversion combined with translation. So it's an analog, a non-relativistic analog of the time component of your special conformal transformation.
What is the upper script in the denominator?
In the
denominator.
Oh, it's mu t.
Mu t.
Mu times t. Mu is just a parameter, constant parameter. So this this is a symmetry you can check. I mean, it's not difficult. So if you adjoin these two symmetries to these 10 plus 1 generators, you get this so-called Schrödinger group. In some ways, it's referred to, I think, a little misleadingly as non-relativistic conformal symmetry, while I think that name should sort of morally belong to the ones that I'll be talking about later. But anyhow, this is the Schrödinger symmetry, and then when I now talk about the Galilean conformal symmetry, we'll contrast it with this. So let me tell you. What that is. So firstly, let's go back to the Galilean group itself and remind ourselves how that arises from the Poincaré group. So essentially, you're taking a non-relativistic limit of the point. So if you take a non-relativistic limit of the Poincaré group, that gives you the Galilean group. So that essentially involves scaling the x's and t's in a way such that there's a relative factor of epsilon. Epsilon going to zero in the limit between them. We'll take r to zero, keep r zero in for most of what follows. But sometimes it's useful to keep this more general scaling. But the main thing is that the spatial directions are scaling down to zero relative to the time direction. And if you wish, epsilon is like v over c. If you now look at the Poincaré generators, so J mu nu, which the boosts and rotations as well as the translations, and if you take this contraction, and this is essentially the process of group contraction. So if you take this scaling limit and appropriately rescale the generators, what you get are the spatial rotations, which are unsurprisingly not changed. There's P0, which for the Hamiltonian, which is that, the translations in space, which are that. But the boosts become much simpler. So the boosts just become t times del del I, which is what gives you the usual Galilean boost, x goes to x plus vt. So that's the sort of, these are the Galilean generators, and they obey the usual Galilean algebra. So now let's just extend the scaling to the relativistic conformal group, to the SO d plus 1, 2, or SO 4, 2. So you have the dilatation, the relativistic dilatation generator, and special conformal transformations. So you have a 2x mu. And so you just do the straightforward scaling of this contraction. And what you find is that the dilatation operator is just the same as the relativistic one, but I have written it out in terms of the spatial and the time pieces. And these over here. So the K0, the time part of the special conformal transformations, just becomes minus 2t xi del del I plus t square del del t. And the ki, the spatial pieces, become just t square del del I. So so this generator over here this scales x's and t's in a uniform way, like you'd have in the relativistic case. So that's unlike the scaling over here. Whereas now you also have these other generators, the special conformal generators, of which the K0 looks a bit like this K tilde, but it's different if you look at the factors. So it's actually, it's in a way, the factor of 2 from here migrates to over here when you do this, take this limit. And then in addition, you have these spatial generators, which also have a simple interpretation. They just generate constant accelerations. So these generated constant boosts. So this essentially generates x goes to x plus at square. So it generates constant accelerations. So you have, in the non-relativistic limit, you get a 15 parameter group, which I won't write down the algebra yet, but let me just tell you some of the features, the main features of the algebra. The first thing is that it's different from the Schrodinger group. The only thing in common is the Galilean group is in common. So they have the 10-parameter Galilean group in common, but this has two additional parameters, and these have sort of five additional parameters in three dimensions. In general, you'll have d extra generators, where d is the number of spatial dimensions. So that's a clear difference. The other interesting thing is that the central term, which was present in the Galilean symmetry, this is equal to zero in this Galilean algebra. So the mass term is not admissible. The reason you could add that central term was that the Jacobi identities were satisfied without it, but with it. But here you find that when you have these extra generators, you can't satisfy the Jacobi identities by having a non-zero term. So in some sense, these are like gapless non-relativistic theories. I'm reluctant to call it massless, but in some sense they are gapless. So there is a, if you just look at this 15 parameter algebra, you can actually add a central term in the commutator of these special conformal transformations with the translations. So the algebra allows a non-zero central term here. And in general dimensions, in fact, in two dimensions, two plus one dimensions, you can have additional pieces with epsilon ij and so on, but those are special to two dimensions. But here you can have this term. I'm not very sure what the interpretation of this this term is, but we'll see that, we'll very shortly actually see that this is not the whole algebra, there's an infinite dimensional version, and in the infinite dimensional case, this term is inadmissible, is not admissible. So it's only in the finite 15 parameter group that you can add this. Once you sort of enlarge the group.
You have a contraction of the Poincaré group. I mean, normally, I would have thought you would start from the algebra, the group,
okay.
The algebra, and then do the contraction at the level of the algebra. And what you've done is start with a representation,
right?
Which, of course, didn't have a central extension.
Yeah.
And then
so then, right? No. Once you have the algebra without the central extension, you can then try to see whether you can add central extensions compatible with the Jacobi identities. And in this case, you find you can't. For this commutator, you cannot. And for this one, you can. So, in particular, there might be systems where this is realized with a non-trivial central charge. But as I'm going to say, this is maybe not of such significance because it's sort of absent when this is actually part of an infinite dimensional group, and in that this term doesn't arise. So we have these gapless sort of algebra. So let me write the algebra in a suggestive way. So if you define the Hamiltonian as L minus 1, the dilatation operator as L 0, and this time component of the special conformal transformation as L 1, then this obeys a SL2R algebra with the usual L 0, L minus 1. So this is an SL2R subalgebra of the whole group. There's a nicer way to write all these boosts and these. So there's BI, there is PI, and there is KI. So you can write them actually as an SL2R triplet. If I define MI plus minus 1 as PI, BI, and KI, these form an SL2R triplet of mutually commuting algebras. And so the full algebra can be very simply encapsulated plus n and the So the whole algebra can be quite simply written in this form, and then there is the rotation generator Gij, the spatial rotation generator, which has obvious commutators. These are scalars, these transform as vectors. So this is the algebra. You can add the central term here, which I mentioned. Okay. So now what I want to say is that this is actually this is not the whole story.
It's the same as the algebra that appeared in fluid dynamics paper.
Except that I guess you had 14 parameters. That was acting trivially. You had the d tilde. So I'll just mention the fluid mechanics this thing later. So this part is essentially it's maybe a little bigger, but it's essentially the algebra that the Navier-Stokes equation had.
I can't help but still think, what's the basic difference between these two conformal, the Schrodinger and the Galilei? Is it the action of the inversion?
So firstly, here the time and space scale differently. That's an obvious difference. Secondly, there are no special conformal generators in this algebra compared to that, and just the commutators are different. I mean, just the Galilean subgroup is in common, and then the commutators are just different.
Physically, your system invariant under inversion, and the inversion acts a different way in both theories.
Yeah, if you wish. I mean, this is inherited from the relativistic inversion. So the inversion would be slightly different. That's why here you had only sort of the analog of time inversion. Here you have sort of the whole. You have the inversion and then translation only in time, whereas here you have inversion and translation in any spatial directions, and so you get this additional.
What are the Casimirs of this?
So I haven't worked out in general. You have the SL2R Casimirs over here, but whether there are higher Casimirs and so on, I'm not very sure. There's a quadratic Casimir which is from the L's, because the SL2R. So whether there are more Casimirs, there should be them. There might be more. I haven't looked at the. You would think that from the conformal group, all the Casimirs, you should be able to take those contraction and get Casimirs of this algebra, because it's just a parametric limit. Of course. So you could get something trivial, but. The conformal group in general has it's like there's an SO4,2 Casimir quadratic Casimir, I think, and probably higher Casimirs also. I'm not very sure. I don't know. There's SO4,2, the obvious Casimir. But I won't be focusing so much on the finite dimensional algebra because in some sense I think.
There's an interesting question. So in some sense you can start take a representation of this algebra, a free master scalar field, okay, and you can. There's a way a master scalar field.
So. Yeah.
To derive that Schrödinger equation from the Klein-Gordon equation, you need to take, it's really, the contraction is mass goes to infinity.
Right, you have to scale them,
So that's how you reduce d/dt squared limit up to a constant, which you can put in, that's how to the Schrodinger equation.
Yes.
The reason there are two differences is probably, right? The Schrodinger symmetry is a contraction somehow when you consider representations of Poincaré group where
with massive with massive right.
And this is where
some kind of a double some scaling limit of
the Poincaré group or the conformable
with the mass strictly equal to zero.
Not equal to zero even. And then let's see what infinity. So there's no
I mean, M not equal to zero, it wouldn't be a representation of the conformal group, but M equal to zero, yeah.
Yeah, but you already had two different contractions, two different non-relativistic limits.
Right. So this is, as you said, from the massive Klein-Gordon, or from a massive scalar particle, but this...
And probably could be derived now as a contraction when...
Actually, I don't know if I can derive the Schrodinger algebra as contraction. I think it's better if you think of it as Lyapunov reduction. You go up one dimension.
But I think you can reduce it from the Klein-Gordon operator as well by taking this kind of a limit.
I think DDT, factorizing a lot, what Dirac first tried, DDT is the square root of m squared plus d squared, right? Minus m to cancel the rest mass, and you have one with plus m. Solution to that equation will. We'll have to satisfy this equation, and then goes to infinity. But it must be possible. Yeah, there are two ways of thinking about the non-relativistic limit. I can see it infinite, or M is infinite.
Right. Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's morally how this comes.
In the formal case, you'd better choose the second
one. Yeah. So in the ADS-CFT, that's why I think this is the natural one to take if you want to take a limit of the interacting Young-Mills theories or interacting whatever relativistic field theories. I think the examples are ones in which there are gravity duals which have the same symmetries as the Schrodinger symmetry, but as far as I know, this is not derived from a parent ADS-CFT duality, right, Mukunda? Or is that an accurate statement? I mean, it's.
I would say it is derived from parent ADS-CFT, but just the same way as.
But you're saying about this null Melvin and this, isn't that a way of generating the gravity solutions, right? But is there a symmetry on the boundary theory? So what does it correspond to on the boundary theory that?
Some non-local deformation.
Okay, so yeah, in that sense, you could, if you introduce these non-local deformations n equal to 4, I guess you could consider that.
So there are metrics which have these.
I'll come to the bulk side shortly. So now what I actually want to say is that this is just sitting inside an infinite dimensional group, which in fact is morally the Galilean, the full Galilean conformal symmetry. And for that, let me just define these generators. So now, if I take n equal to, at least for these, if I take n equal to 0 plus minus 1, I get exactly these generators that I had. So you have the SL2R and you have this triplet. Here, of course, we had just the rotation, n equal to 0. But now you take n to be any integer. And the nice thing is that you find, firstly, you find that these generators obey exactly this algebra, without now for any n, not n plus minus 1. So they obeyed this algebra. And in addition, you have the commutators with the commutators of these L's with these currents is exactly a Kac-Moody symmetry. This is sort of like a loop group, if you wish, representation. The J, N, J, B, M is F, A, B, C. So far without any central extension, because I'm working at the level of the generators, this representation in terms of differential vector fields. So this and this together form an infinite dimensional algebra where you have a Virasoro, again, admitting the central extension is allowed with these extra generators, the usual central extension, similarly in the current algebra. And then you have these sort of mutually commuting generators, which as well. So I've written down this infinite family of transformations. What's the meaning of these generators? Well, the meaning is fairly simple. This Ji, Jn essentially generate time-dependent rotations, independent of space, but arbitrary time. That's what these do, and that's straightforward. These Min essentially generate spatially independent but arbitrarily time dependent translations. So any function of t. So x goes to x plus some function of t. That's what these min clearly generate. The ln's are a little more interesting. They generate essentially reparametrizations of time under which the axis scale like this, df by dt. So that's essentially what these generators do. They generate time-dependent rotations, translations, and sort of reparametrizations. And they obey this algebra. What we sort of argued in our paper, was that this, in fact, is the maximal set of Galilean conformal isometries and in a later paper just a few weeks ago by some mathematical physicists, Dual and Horvathy, they in fact showed it in a much more clean way why this should be, this can be understood as the natural set of the Galilean conformal isometries. In a way, in the sense that the way they showed it is you just use the usual definition of a conformal isometry that essentially generates scaling of the metric, but now you have to take a non-relativistic limit of that, and the natural way to take the non-relativistic limit essentially leads you to the conclusion that these are the general transformations that preserve the non-relativistic Galilean structure. So in a way, it's very parallel to the way in which you usually argue about the relativistic conformal group. You get the fact that the killing equations or the conformal killing equations give you the finite dimensional SOD, 2 in dimensions greater than 2, and the Virasoro generators in dimension equal to 2. It's very parallel to that, except that here, in any dimension, you get this sort of infinite set of conformal isometries. So there's this sort of rich kinematic structure that's present in any in the non-relativistic limit, which is not present in the original relativistic theory, which is what makes me think that this should be useful and exploitable. So let me now shift to something at first sight sort of different, which is to go to point number three, talk about what this means in any ADS-CFT example. In particular, can you see these symmetries, these Galilean conformal isometries, how are they reflected in the bulk side of the ADS-CFT? Yes.
Technical question about the L's. I mean, I usually think of your external algebra as the algebra of diff S1.
Right.
You're saying it's difficult to align. I
don't think those are the same. I'm not sure.
Well, at the level of the algebra, they are the same. I mean, I don't. There are lots of technical things about exponentiating the Virasoro group to a Virasoro algebra to a group. So I don't know, but yeah. So at least at the level of the algebra, it's the same. There might be some. So something to worry about there, but I'm not sure. Any other questions?
Okay, can you obtain this by contracting the affine extension of the conformal group?
I don't know. Actually, yeah, that's a good question. I haven't looked at that. There might be. There might be a way to, but what role does the affine extension play in the original relativistic case? Does it? Because here there's a natural interpretation of them as actual conformal isometries, so it seems to sort of be more intrinsically tied to the symmetries of the theory. I should maybe mention the connection here with fluid mechanics. You might ask, what is a system where some of this is realized, a concrete system where you can see some of this? So if you actually take the relativistic Navier-Stokes equation, which describes, say, n equal to 4 plasma small fluctuations near equilibrium, then you can take the non-relativistic limit of that, and this was done by several people, Shiraz and student and Spenta, and also Yaron Oz and collaborators, and later Mukund also had and collaborators had related work. So you can take the non-relativistic limit of the relativistic Navier-Stokes equation, and you, not surprisingly, you get the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation. But in the process, Shiraz et al. Observed that you get essentially this finite dimensional symmetry algebra, and they also it was known to some some mathematical physicists working on fluid mechanics that it's also invariant under this set of transformations under arbitrary time. So the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation is actually has a larger invariance than the Galilean symmetry. It firstly has all this. So if you set the viscous term to zero and get the Euler fluid, then it has all these as symmetries. If the viscous term is not zero, then that breaks the that sets a scale. So that breaks the but the Euler equation, for instance, has all these symmetries, but it has more. It has these, and a student of mine has been recently looking at the properties of the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation under these, and he seems to find that you have a more general covariance of the Navier-Stokes equation in a very natural way under these more general transformations. So it's something a little bit not obvious when you just look at the Navier-Stokes equations, but it's there. And
sorry, I got confused. You said there's a more general covariance of the Navier-Stokes equation. This is
more general covariance.
Now with non-zero viscosity.
Yes, even with non-zero viscosity, there's a covariance which under which the viscosity would also have to be, because the viscosity in particular breaks the scale symmetry, would have to transform, say, under scaling in a particular way. And yeah, so I mean, this is sort of still work in progress, so I don't want to be 100% this thing, but it looks as if there is covariance under all this. So so much for this Galilean conformal algebra. So if you have to take this limit in ADS CFT, we better know how to take the corresponding non-relativistic limit on the bulk side as well. And this should be, and you would expect the structure to be reflected if you've taken the limit correctly. So what we we propose is that the non-relativistic limit on the bulk side is to be taken in a way which is maybe a little unfamiliar. It goes by the name of, it's essentially taking the non-relativistic limit of Einstein's equations. So there is actually a geometric way of taking the non-relativistic limit of Einstein's equations. When most of us teach general relativity, we talk about the non-relativistic limit, but there's actually a nice geometric way of phrasing all that, which goes by the name of Newton-Cartan gravity. So it was something essentially developed by Cartan shortly after Einstein, and it's textbook material, at least if your textbook is Misner, Thorn, and Wheeler. So, but it's sort of a little obscure part of general relativity. A variant of this is what I think is the right framework for capturing the bulk side of this non-relativistic limit, and we'll see it naturally reflects these symmetries. So to describe this, let me quickly sort of describe this non-relativistic limit of flat space, or asymptotically flat space Einstein equations. So the tricky thing about taking the non-relativistic limit in a geometric way is that the metric degenerates. The Lorentzian metric has dt square much greater than dx square when you take this limit. So there's no non-trivial metric that you can have on the space-time. But nevertheless, Cartan gave a geometric description, so it's a non-metric description. So it's a non-metric theory, and the dynamical variables are the connections. So these connections will be taken to be torsion-free, but otherwise general affine connections. So they are not metric connections, though it's in particular they are not Christoffel connections, because there's no metric. These are the dynamical variables, but they obey certain constraints. So what you do have, you have non-dynamical metrics in both your space and time directions. So there's a spatial metric, which will be taken to be a sort of a contravariant tensor. And then there's a, which will have sort of three non-zero eigenvalues and one zero eigenvalue. So it's sort of, you can't invert it. So there's a difference between contravariant and covariant. And there's a temporal metric which has, denoted by G mu nu, which has sort of one non-zero eigenvalue and the rest zero. So you have sort of these two metrics. If you wish, you can find coordinates where this is just dt square and these are just maybe flat Euclidean space and dxi. Dx square. So the connections are constrained by being compatible with these metrics. So you have So the covariant derivatives of these vanish. And there's a further relation that one has to impose on the connection, which is trivially satisfied for a Christoffel connection, but not here. So you define essentially gamma nu alpha r mu alpha sigma. So if you define this to be r mu mu, R sigma lambda, then so here you can, this is written purely in terms of the connections. So if you define this quantity, then you additionally require that it's symmetric under simultaneous interchange of both these indices. So you require that this is sort of symmetric under. So that's sort of the geometric structure that you impose on the spacetime, and geometrically it's essentially you have time and then you have the spatial slices, the d-dimensional spatial slices over it as some kind of a fiber bundle, and these connections are what tell you how to go from one slice to another. How does this relate to our familiar notion of the Newtonian limit? That comes about when you take special coordinates. So if you choose coordinates where this gamma mu nu, so where this gamma is just delta ij, the usual Euclidean metric, and g to be just dt square, in which case these constraints and everything actually tell you that the non-zero elements of the connection are just these, and in fact these are actually gradients of some function, and then you write down, I forgot to write, the equations of motion are essentially Einstein equations, look like Einstein equations, but with small. So it's Einstein's equations written in this way, where this is this time metric, and you can define t appropriately. So then in these coordinates, this equation just reduces to the normal Poisson equation for the Newtonian gravity. So it's a very baroque way of capturing Newtonian gravity in a geometric framework.
It's more general because you could have had, I mean,
you could have had other spatial slices, right? So that's why I think this has found some use. I don't know. I mean, you see some body of literature on Newton-Cartan cosmology and so on. So people sort of have exploited this a little bit in that context.
What I mean, it is then more than just Newtonian gravity on an arbitrary curve space background.
More in what sense?
Does the spatial background ever evolve in time, or is the spatial vacuum? Is the spatial part of the metric always the same at all times?
No, it need not be.
Okay.
So you have to. I mean, these metrics are not dynamical, but. So I think you can capture it equivalently in terms of the same spatial metric but different connections. So you sort of move the effects of the geometry onto the connection and phrase things in that language. But I think you can talk of cosmology in such a setup. But I'm not an expert on that.
What is the symmetry of these gravities? Like,
So over here there are, so this is written in a generally covariant way, but with some constraints, but otherwise it's sort of written in a generally covariant way. That was the whole point of writing it in this language.
It fails to preserve the metric?
It need not preserve the form of the metric, because you could just transform these in the appropriate way, but there might be some restriction on trying to, because there's some orthogonality conditions and so on, but everything is written essentially in a covariant way. So I think you can sort of transform it. You break the covariance in a way by choosing this to be a time-like and this to be spatial, but you can formally write it in a covariant way.
Same gauge symmetry as Einstein theory.
Yeah. So, but this was just in flat space, in flat space, and we are interested in sort of an ADS bulk. So what should appear here is sort of slightly different. So we have a D plus one dimensional boundary theory. My conventions were such that D is the number of spatial directions. So if there was an ADS D plus two dual to that, you want to take a non-relativistic limit of this. So of course you know that the boundary, on the boundary you know that these scale in the following way, but now you have this extra additional direction in ADS, and so you have to sort of to take the non-relativistic limit, you have to describe what the additional direction does, since the additional direction has the interpretation of being sort of like an energy scale, it seems natural. Let's say we are in Poincaré coordinates and this is the radial direction in Poincaré coordinates, it seems natural to let that also scale like t as epsilon to the zero, and we'll see why that makes sense. So in the limit, in this non-relativistic limit, what you have is an ADS 2 sitting inside your ADS d plus 2, which survives this non-relativistic limit, and then you have these spatial directions. So the sort of proposal is that instead of a geometry where you have just this time, you have an ADS 2, and you have these slices of time fibered over it, and in a very similar way to over here. So you put metrics, non-dynamical metrics, on your ADS2 and on these spatial slices, and then you take take your connection variables to be the dynamical ones, so being just minor variants of these conditions. So what's the sort of what's the reason to believe it? So what we'll see now is that this kind of structure admits exactly the same set of so we'll see that the asymptotic isometries of this ADS2 structure, whatever ADS2 Newton-Cartan geometry, these are this are exactly this Galilean conformal isometries, and so this is best seen in by writing the ADS metric, ADS2 metric, in some kind of infalling Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. So I one writes it. So z is sort of, so this is just the usual Poincaré coordinates, but you go beyond the horizon by going into the infalling coordinates. So in these coordinates, you can actually write down vector fields which actually obey the same algebra. So if you these are now vector fields on your ADS 2 times this RD, and if you compute their commutators, you get exactly these commutators, and moreover, they reduce and on the boundary. So the boundary is sort of z equal to 0. So on the boundary at z equal to 0, they reduce exactly to these generators that we had earlier. So these are a set of vector fields in the bulk which obey the same algebra, reduce on the boundary to the boundary generators. And if you look at the n equal to 0 plus minus 1 case, these are exactly the contraction of the ADS-5 isometries. So the ADS-5 isometries, if you take the contraction, you get these. So the these finite dimensional, this infinite set of vector fields is a natural candidate for the asymptotic isometries. And in fact, if you just look at the action of these vector fields on the metric, you find that they do, in fact, these two are trivially sort of isometries of the full structure. So this is the ADS2 piece of the metric, and then there's a piece gamma, which is sort of z squared delta ij. So these are isometries of this, and these, the LNs, the Virasoro generators, if you wish, they are asymptotic isometries. So the LNs are.
So you said they're exact isometries as well, right?
So there are exact isometries. The SL2R subset is the exact isometries. So it's like in ADS2. So there are asymptotic isometries in the Brown-Hanno sense. So in the Brown and Hanno sense, you can check that they are exactly the same kind of asymptotic isometry. So these LNs have an interpretation as being the one copy of the Virasoro of this, which you expect this ADS2 to have. And then you have the whole current algebra coming from the spatial slices as well.
Question?
Yeah.
So, in the Brown-Hanno sense, the charges also are realized in some
computer. Right, exactly.
They associate to finite charges, and they are really related.
Yes.
These generators, could you realize them?
No, that's a very interesting question, and I think something that should be done, which is to redo the Brown-Hanno sort of analysis, write down the canonical charges, the charges corresponding to these vector fields, and that's how you would find the central charge. If there's a central extension, that's how you would, like Brown-Hanno found the central charge.
That's how you would find the generator really exists.
In the quantum theory acting on the Hilbert space or whatever, right? Yeah. But ADS2, it's a little bit more tricky. I mean, I think there have been some people like Hartmann and Strominger and some others who have for ADS2, but with not just pure gravity, but gravity with gauge fields. redone the Brown-Hanno analysis, but it's a little bit more tricky. But I think it's definitely something that should be done. So in a way, this is at the sort of at the geometric level that you know that there are these isometries, but you would expect that you should be able, in some canonical framework, be able to construct the charges and compute their central extension.
Except for the fact that, on general principles, if these charges exist, they have to vanish. Whenever you have symmetries in a phase space context that involve arbitrary functions of time, they have to be gauge symmetries.
No, but I thought in the boundary, like in the ADS3 case, in the boundary you have but they're arbitrary functions of the boundary, Z and Z bar, right? That's what the Brown and Hanno isometries are. Right, you get a holomorphic function and an anti-holomorphic function. That's why you get two copies of the Virasoro generators, and that's why you have the boundary theory is in a representation of the two copies of the Virasoro algebra.
The charges would be, either zero or infinite, because you have to integrate over a plane or over something.
Right.
In the case, you have a cylinder at infinity, you have the charge as just integrated over a cylinder. But here, how would you define the charges? On what would you integrate?
Well, so I've been working in these Poincaré coordinates, and you have the boundary at z equal to zero, which is where you know these charges, these generators act in the boundary theory. So I think the situation is no different from the usual ones of ADS2. I mean, the ADS2 version of the Brown-Hanno.
ADS2, I think the charges have to vanish. ADS3, there are arbitrary functions of a null coordinate, which is very different.
But if you look, I don't know if you've seen the paper of Hartmann and Strominger, they compute a non-zero central charge for ADS2 gravity with gauge field.
The argument is so simple, I give it to you in 5 seconds. If the charge is conserved, if the charge exists as a well-defined operator in the phase space, it has to be conserved. But if you can have an arbitrary time dependence, then you can simply choose a generator that generates a non-trivial operation for a while, and then in the future becomes trivial. And therefore, you can evaluate the charge on any surface, in particular on one where it's trivial, and it has to be zero.
I mean, in the ADS2 cases, I think there are a number of calculations which do claim to show a non-zero central charge. Andy's paper, I mean, it was a year ago or something like that. Andy had a paper which computes for gravity plus gauge fields. They do a Brown-Hanno-like analysis, find a non-zero central charge. Yeah, I can tell you the reference. You can see. There have been others as well, but this is the most recent, the recent one. So in any case, I think in any particular realization in the boundary theory, you would see a central charge which would be reflected, I think, in the bulk theory as well. So I was going to close with several questions, some of which include this about the central charge. So the other, I think, pressing questions are to identify what is the sector within n equal to 4 Yang-Mills theory which is governed by this kind of algebra. Again, naively, you might think that in this non-relativistic limit, you get only some quantum mechanical worth of degrees of freedom. But again, the example of the plasma suggests that since there are modes described by the non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equation, there should be a field theory worth of modes when you take the non-relativistic limit. I think Joma Gomez has some suggestions of what the sector would be. It's sort of, by the way, there is a simple way to realize this ADS2 times SOD symmetry, which is to consider sort of a Wilson line in the time direction. So you would have, so you just consider sort of an, there was one thing which I forgot to say over here, which is that one way of understanding this limit is to try to go into the vicinity of a radial, a null radial geodesic in ADS. So that's what the vicinity of a null radial geodesic. If you don't take something like a Penrose limit, you get a geometry something like this. But people like Nadal and so on have studied Wilson lines, which have an ADS2 times S2 symmetries in four dimensions. Or rather, they have an SL2R times the SO3 symmetry. And Gomez's proposal is that there should be, it should be this Wilson line with various operators inserted along it, somewhat like the BMN sector. But I think it would be good to make that sort of sharper and test it in some non-trivial way. So there are a number of other things to do with understanding this Newton-Cartan limit better, since it's something a little unfamiliar, but it should be possible to look at various black hole-like solutions, what their limits go into, what their limits are, and work out the bulk to boundary dictionary in this cases. So there have been, by the way, I forgot to mention, there have been people who have looked at the constraints on correlation functions of this algebra. So these students at HRI have looked at 2 and 3 point functions, and you find they are much more constrained than in the Schrodinger case. In fact, just like in the relativistic case, they are fixed essentially. But that was without using this infinite dimensional symmetry. So one would think, just like in the 2D CFTs, you should be able to constrain correlation functions even more using this. Supersymmetric versions also have been sort of studied a little bit, but I think no one has found a super Virasoro yet, which I think should be there. There should be a natural way to take the non-relativistic limit, which has a super Virasoro sort of super Gauss-Moody algebra. So I should maybe stop here since I've sort of run over time. Thanks.
Do you know of a